Welcome to Open Air, the Bay Area's radio broadcast for all forms of arts here in the Bay Area. My name's Peter Robinson. I'm standing in this week for David Latulli. And we have a really varied lineup. We have the Fool's Fury Theatre Company. I'll be speaking to the director, Deborah Slater. And we move on to a whole world of mime. The mime troupe are producing a play, a musical, Seeing Red, a time-travelling musical. So we'll have everybody in to tell us all about that. And then later, David himself is doing an interview with the solo performance at the Marsh Theatre, talking about what one-man shows are and how that works. And we're going to start the show with an interview between two actors, the actor Courtney Walsh and the director Rush Rame, for the Stamford Repertory Theatre. And their production is called Hecuba and Helen. Yeah, well, I want to welcome an old friend to the studio today, Rush Rame. He is the artistic director of the Stamford Repertory Theatre. This, in fact, is the celebration of the 20th celebration of the summer season. And we're going to be talking about a play which has two leading females played by one person, Courtney Walsh. The play, Hecuba and Helen. Rush, welcome to KLW.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
And for people who, I always say, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. Well, what gifts do these Greeks have to bear? Who are the Trojans? Who are the Egyptians? And how do they come together in Hecuba and Helen?
Great. So Hecuba Helen is our adaptation of two plays by the 5th century Athenian playwright Euripides. The first one, Hecuba, deals with the Queen of Troy after the fall of Troy during the Trojan War. So the Trojan War has happened. Hecuba is now a slave to the Greeks. And by virtue of her persistence and resilience and cleverness, manages to effect some kind of payback for the degradation she suffered. The second play, Helen, deals with Hecuba's nemesis, Helen of Troy, the most beautiful woman in the world, and her abduction to Troy. It was the ostensible cause of the Trojan War. But in Euripides' version of the play, Helen never actually went to Troy. She remained true to her Greek husband. She was sequestered in Egypt, and the gods, fickle gods, sort of like ours, made an image or a clone of Helen and sent it to Troy. So the second play, Helen, deals with Helen's persistence in Egypt, waiting for her husband and helping him and her to effect an escape from the land of Egypt back to Greece. So the first play, Hecuba, is something of a tragedy. The second play, Helen, is something of a comedy with a kind of romantic marriage reunion at the end.
And we're very lucky today to have both Helen and Hecuba here, alive, living in one single body. Welcome, Courtney Walsh. Tell us a little bit about schizophrenia and how you managed to change roles.
Oh, it's a wonderful challenge. The two women are quite different, and in fact, they speak of each other, which is interesting. I speak of myself in each play as my alter ego, but they are so different in their physical bearing, in the tone of the language that they use, that it's not that difficult for me to affect the transformation. I hope the audience will come along for the ride, since there will obviously be certain physical traits about me that look similar. But Hecuba is fierce and enslaved, and Helen is glamorous and clever. Mm-hmm. And so just a change in bearing, I use a different vocal register for the two women. All of those things, plus
costuming. What about
costuming?
Did you go through a costume change?
Yes, actually, one of the more wonderful aspects of the production is being able to see the transition. We don't hide it from the audience, so that at the end of Hecuba, you see me, the actress, transform into Helen.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was the face that launched 1,000 ships, so what do you do with your face as you've gone from Hecuba to Helen?
No pressure. I have a wonderful wig. And there will be, of course, a makeup transition. But even in the publicity photos, you can see what an amazing difference the makeup can do.
Yeah, the headdress.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
And just toning down or toning up certain features. And again, I think posture and voice has a lot to do with the difference as well.
Good. Now, we use some music because it is a play about ships sailing, crossing seas, arriving at different places. Let's hear a little bit of the music. If we
Great.
Could.
Here's something by Michael Keck for the play Hecuba. So this is the music near the beginning of Hecuba to set the scene in Asia Minor. You can tell by the clarinet sound that it's a northern Greek sound. And it helps to set the mood of the piece. We go through many different transitions in the music. It's very, very much involved in the role of the chorus, these friends of Hecuba, and then in Egypt of Helen. The music shifts from a kind of Thracian northern Greece sound to a North African sound in the second play. There are wonderful dance rhythms and powerful emotional moments affected by the music. And the composer of the piece is Michael Keck from New York City.
Now, you've mentioned location in relation to this music, so we go from Greece to Egypt, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the sets.
Right. Well, because the part of our production is going to travel to Greece, we had to think about where we're playing in Athens in September. We had to think about how this could be affected. And a decision was made by the costume and set designer, Connie Strayer, to use fabric for the sets. So we have refugee tents, much like a refugee camp now in Greece or Asia Minor, or sadly in too many places in the world. That's for the first play, because remember, Hecuba is a slave and her Trojan women are all slaves to the Greeks. Through theatrical magic, we transform those refugee tents into a great grand palatial tent, something like for the Sheikh Pharaoh, if you will, king of Egypt, from whom Helen is trying to escape in the second play. So we use transformation of these tent-like fabric structures. Also, we have projections on this big, giant tent-like background, not a screen, in which we suggest the change of place, but also the natural elements that are so important in any Greek myth, particularly the sea, but also the movement of the stars and the sun and the moon and the sky. The Greeks were very close to nature, and it would be a mistake, I think, to attack Greek tragedy or try to deal with it without confronting that reality. And, of course, as you know, Greek tragedy was originally played outdoors during the daytime, so the elements were never hidden as they are in our theater.
Yeah. So, Courtney, we spoke a little early on about this being a play about strong but different characters of women, Hecuba and Helen. And, of course, we're going back many thousands of years to the Greeks, but how does it speak to today?
Well, I think what intrigues me about the women in this play, these two plays, are that they are both underestimated by the world. They are presumed, in the case of Hecuba, to be without power. She's a defeated queen. She's old. She's eventually childless. And, in fact, she has great reserves of strength and is able to take vengeance on those who've harmed her and her children. So there are a number of lines, actually, by Euripides, with the men underestimating her and the power of her Trojan women, who are almost invisible to the men because they're just women slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And in Helen, it's a different way of being underestimated, that she's presumed to be a beautiful, promiscuous airhead who caused all of this pain and suffering for everyone, when in fact she stayed true to her husband. And not only that, she's the one who has to figure out how to get them out of Egypt when her great war hero husband comes back. He's incapable of solving the problem, but she can do it.
Yeah, so the two very contrasting type of women all in your body. So.
Yes.
Now, of course, every Greek play, in my opinion, has a chorus. And let's hear from you, Rush, if we could. Who or what does the chorus represent?
Great. Well, one of the wonderful things about working on Greek tragedy is that you get to work with a chorus. Some directors think it's a pain. It is the greatest gift a theatrical director could ever have. Why is that? Well, to begin with, the chorus represents something identifiable. In the case of the first play, Hecuba, they are Trojan slaves, friends of Hecuba. In the case of the second play, they are Greek slaves, but friends of Helen. So that's their sort of identity. But the freedom of Greek chorus means that they can range across time and space, mythology, poetry, and leave the constraints of psychological realism to create a different kind of world. And that's the fun part.
And is the speaking in dirge poetic, iambic pentameters? What is it?
Well, they had various meters in Greek tragedy. I won't go into it. Greek's an inflected language. It allows you to do all sorts of things with the language you cannot do in English. I just can't do it. You just absolutely cannot do it. What we've done is adopted, I think, an understandable various meters that are not don't sound so poetical as more, I would say, they're sort of lyrical or song-like without being sung. Mm-hmm. The strongest point about the chorus, though, is the movement. And we have a wonderful choreographer, Alita Hayes, who I've worked with on many plays in the past, who has developed the movement with our wonderful female chorus. And in addition to this lyrical and dance-like effects that they bring, they are also, of course, in solidarity with Hecuba and Helen. And that brings us back to the sort of theme of our festival, which we're calling Nevertheless They Persisted, Hecuba Helen, as a reminder about, even in the old days, people were dealing with the power of women and the failure of men to understand that power and to take it on board, to accept it, and also to get out of the way of it, as opposed to simply resisting it. And so the chorus play an enormously important part in the whole.
So I'm still fascinated with this power of women. If I was to run into you, Courtney, on the street, would you be Hecuba or Helen?
Depends on who you were and what time of day it was. I relate to both of them. In my more glorious moments, I definitely feel a bit of Helen. But there's plenty of Hecuba in there. I'm a mother, too, and can be quite fierce the way she is when anything threatens my family.
And if we look at some of the other cast, who are we going to run into on this stage?
Right. Well, we have some heroes from the Trojan War. Some of you may know Agamemnon. The leader of the Greeks' expedition, his brother Menelaus, who lost Helen to Paris. They are the most famous of the Greek soldiers. Also Odysseus, whom you will know from the Odyssey and from other stories. He plays an important role in Hecuba. And then the Egyptians we meet are not, well, they're not household names. They weren't household names in Euripides' time. He invented them. One is a prophetess, Theonoe, a sort of New Age seer, but also a strong female voice. And her brother, Theoclymenus, who I guess in some sense is the bad guy. We have the good fortune of having a wonderful actor and also magician who plays Theoclymenus, and so you'll see some live magic as well.
So we've got magic, we've got soothsayers, we've got the chorus, we've got a schizophrenic Hecuba and Helen.
You got it all.
And it's all happening at the Stanford Repertory Theatre. It's running July, August. And Rush, what's the best way to get hold and find tickets?
Great. Well, the best thing is to go to our website, which is stanfordreptheater.com. That's theater, T-E-R at the end, stanfordreptheater.com. Or you can call 650-725-5838 and leave information about tickets you may want. The website has all sorts of information about the whole festival, including our free film series and some other activities connected with Hecuba Helen.
So that's StanfordRepTheatre.com for a really exciting and contemporary production of Hecuba and Helen. It's got a twist. You won't recognize the ending. It is the Helen with the 1,000 ships, but it's also Hecuba with the spirit of revenge. Great for the summer. Take a trip down to Palo Alto. Enjoy the Stanford Repertory Theatre. And I want to thank you, Courtney, for coming in.
Thank you.
And again, Rush, thank you for guiding us through one of the great mysteries of time. What was Euripides really talking about?
Come and see.
Okay. Festival, and I want to say straight away we're all nodding our heads to the rhythm in that particular piece. So I'm going to welcome Ben Yallop, who is the founder and co-artistic director of Fury Theatre Company, and also Deborah Slater, who has been doing a lot of the choreography, long-time involvement. Welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about how the Fury Factory Festival has come together. I know it's been running a long time, so tell us a little bit about the history.
Sure, yes. This is our seventh festival. We do it every other year. And the reason we began it and why we keep doing it is we're very interested in what is currently being called devised work or ensemble work, work that's being created by ensembles of artists collaboratively. It's not so much the more mainstream playwright-centric model of theater in which a playwright gives a company a script and they interpret it, but rather these are new works that are being created collaboratively by the many artists that make up a theater company or a dance theater company, as in Deb's case. And what we do every other year is we bring between 20 and 25 different companies from around the country. Usually about half are local and half are national. In this case, we have somebody coming from Vancouver as well, so we're international. And we bring them together over a two-week period, and we put up a lot of different art. We'll have about 45 productions over a two-week period, and people can see what tends to be rather cutting-edge art, but in many different modes, so not hopefully inaccessible, but rather there's dance theater, there's circus, there's puppetry, there's more conventional theater, but usually with a very physical bent. And I think what all of these pieces have in common to some extent is they're highly creative, they're innovative, they may not look like what you think of when you think of theater with a capital T, but they tend to be very timely, and they all tend to focus a bit on what it means to be live, be having live performance where an audience needs to be there at the moment of performance and not something that is so removed where you're an audience member and 150 feet away, there's a play that's
so it's very intimate.
Yes.
And Deborah, I know you're involved with the choreography, amongst other things. So that piece of music that we heard at the beginning, mm-hmm. What would be the visual you'd see on stage while that was playing?
That piece is called Take Place, and it's by Beth Custer, and we're using it as a launching point for people in a subway waiting on the sides to get on a bus, going past each other, seeing each other, ignoring each other, running into each other. It's the beginning of ways that people are civil and uncivil in very simple, straightforward human ways. Mm-hmm. And that's the music that's running behind it.
Now, there's at least 12 different type of productions going on here. Which two are you involved with, Deborah?
I'm involved with one piece. It's Deborah Slater Dance Theater. The piece that we're making is called In Civility, and it's in response to the current environment, which we were all so discouraged about that we started talking about it and then realized that we didn't want to make a piece that reflected everything that was happening. We wanted to make a piece that had hope in it about transformation and that people can come together. So it's a series of duets and trios and quartets where people just keep running into each other and changing how they interact.
And when they change, are we talking about conversations? Are we talking about dance? Are we talking about how do they depict the actual change?
It's physical. It's movement. It's dance-based. Some of it is pedestrian. Much of it is full-out dancing. A lot of lifting, tossing, groups of people smooshing together and coming out someplace else, doing other things. But it's a dance-based piece. It has a poem in it by Maggie Smith called Good Bones, which is sort of sets the tone for me of the piece. And her idea is that there's many things that have happened in life, but she's trying to sell life to her kids and make it be okay. And it's like a realtor going into a house and saying, yeah, well, it's kind of a mess, but you could make this a good place.
So it's really like transformation or turning points.
One hopes. Turning points
where people go from being one thing to becoming something different.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I noticed this year you've got the regular venues and you have a new venue over in Oakland. So how many venues do you have altogether?
So the festival will have four different venues this year. What we've been doing since the beginning is taking over the relatively small venues in the Project Arteau building in San Francisco. So there are three venues there, the Joe Good Annex, the No Space, and Z Below, which used to be Traveling Jewish Theater when we started the festival. Mm-hmm. And this year we're super excited to add some performances at the Flight Deck in Oakland. And the idea is to start to try to shrink that the Bay Bridge, which is such a big hurdle in people's minds, but there's wonderful culture happening on both sides of the bridge, and we're excited to be teaming with the Flight Deck for the first time, partnering with them.
So part of your concern must be when booking these is the sense of space and how do you put these productions on in these different spaces?
Yeah, it hasn't been a huge problem. There have over the years been some shows that we would like to have brought in that we haven't had quite a large enough space for. And in some cases, with new pieces in particular, there's been the concern that actually they're in too small a space, too big a space, and they need to be in something a little more intimate to get their first life. The festival breaks up between main stage shows, that is, full shows usually that have been performed before and are very polished, and that's the large majority of the shows. But then we also have a very important works in progress series where we'll bring 3 to 4 companies on a given night. We'll give them 20 minutes. They'll bring in excerpts of their work, and you can see and be involved in the creative process with these artists. And in fact, Deb's wonderful company started off doing some works in progress at the festival, and then finally we coerced her into doing some fully staged pieces. Deb's such a wonderful choreographer and dance theater maker that to have her doing that work seemed very important to us to represent local dance theater companies. And one thing that's happened over the years is that some companies have grown up through the works in progress and are now making more fully staged works and being seen on larger stages nationally as well.
And Deborah, are you in on the auditions when people want to present and actually?
Not for the factory itself. They have an application process. You submit what you want to do, and then there's a group of people inside the Fury group that pick those people. So I was lucky enough to be picked, but I think they sort of trust that I know what I'm doing by now, so. Mm-hmm. Whatever I say, they think I can pull it off, and I have my fingers crossed.
Yeah,
but at some point, you've seen all the productions, have you?
I've seen many of them, yeah.
Yeah, and is there a theme? I know we spoke about change with the first one you were talking about, or what sort of theme?
Let me field that one if I can, I'm sort of in charge of the whole thing. My company, Fool's Fury, are the producers of the Fury Factory. And this year, we're not a themed festival per se. We don't present a theme and everybody has to apply around that theme, as some festivals are. But it was very clear this year, as people were applying, we received applications in record numbers, and the vast majority of them were in some way touching upon discomfort with the current political situation, dissent, protest, and I would say probably a good half of the shows that people can see when they come to the festivals have some element. Deb's piece in Civility, talking about how can we be hopeful about the future and given the current circumstances. Some of these speeches are much more outraged. I think we're all outraged, but we're dealing with it in different ways.
So is this theater as propaganda?
Some of it is, some of it's not. I would say that the one piece I wanted to point to is there's a wonderful company called UMO coming down from Vashon Island near Seattle, and they're doing what is called their Resistance Cabaret, and it's sort of a cabaret of different acts, but it's framed within a buffoon world with multiple Donald Trump buffoons. And there are the Miss America ladies in white, who are sort of a chorus of nuns who make up the other polar side of that.
And one's called Infinite Resistance.
No, this is a different one. This one's called the Resistance Cabaret, and it's going to start off the first week, and it's going to be, I think, great fun and a good place to get your frustrations out. And then the San Francisco Neo-Futurists are doing Infinite Resistance the second week at the Flight Deck, which is a series of short plays that are all protest plays.
And what do the woodland creatures get up to?
Ah, the woodland creatures. This is a company called Marzipanic. It's a relatively new company in the Bay Area led by Ryan Hill, a great theater maker who came to us from Minneapolis, and a number of great theater makers who've been in the Bay Area for a long time. And it's a very unusual piece. It's actually three pieces in one, and it's sort of some questioning of people attempting to understand the place in the world with large rabbit masks and a wolf mask and a chorus. So.
And Deborah, just to make a distinction between body movements, which you've spoken about, and choreography, what's the difference between that and mime in your experience?
Well, when people use mime, they're usually trying to indicate something very specific. It's, this is how you open a door, something concrete. They're referring generally to something concrete. I mean, that's a gross overstatement. But in this work, the pieces were made from things like they were given the task of creating a movement sequence for enemy and a movement task for friend. And then they would put those together, or they would interact with each other and build more movements out of those. So there's an idea, an emotional basis, sometimes a specific a word that they're building from to make something. So it doesn't end up literal in the same way that mime might be.
Okay, Ben, let's go over to you now. You're at these four different venues, so what is the best place to get information if you want to book tickets?
Well, go to foolsfury.org. That's our website, foolsfury.org, and it will have information on all of the shows. It's outlined visually. It's also outlined as a calendar, so you can see when the shows are performing. There's a great deal of performance and also workshops with master teachers, including Deb is teaching one this year. And there are panels. So we're doing panels on key issues for theater makers, particularly ensemble theater makers. There'll be one on queerness in ensemble theater, one on the changing nature of live. I said all these focus on live theater, but virtual reality and things of that sort of creeping into our lives, I think liveness is changing. And there's one on claiming different narratives in America. So workshops, performances, panels, all of those things happening, and a piece with the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of America. And you can learn about all of these at foolsfury.org.
So this runs from July the 10th to July the 22nd. It's on both sides of the bay, quite literally. It is the Fury Factory Festival with dance, music, resistance, political savvy, maybe propaganda, maybe not propaganda, but certainly a exciting night out. Again, the Fury Factory Festival. And I want to thank you, Deborah, for coming in today.
Thank you.
And also, Ben, thank you for explaining what is a old San Francisco tradition, but still needs to have it explained. Thank
Absolutely.
You for being here.
Thank you.
Award-winning actor, comedian, internet personality, and writer whose YouTube videos have been viewed by more than 20 million people. He's currently in his own one-man show as Dale Thorhammer, transformation artist to the stars, in his one-man show at the Marsh called Stop Stopping the Unstoppable, now through July 28th, and he joins me in studio. Hi, Ross.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, this is a ripe topic for parody. What sort of real-life experiences are feeding into your show?
Oh, so much. I've been doing personal development work since about 2012 at the behest of my friends and family and loved ones.
Oh, nice.
I feel like there's few things more insulting than people being like, I think you should get a life coach. You know, you're like, why? What am I doing wrong? What's wrong with my life? But it wound up being what I call a love-laugh relationship with that whole world because I got so much out of it, but I was like, I really hate doing this. There's like an air of pretentiousness, and it almost feels like you're joining a cult at some points. And like, there's a lot of discomfort and unease when you're going into this world of personal development. And although after every step I took, after every program I did, I'd feel really good and confident about myself, and like the problems that I had in my life would start to, you know, I'd be able to manage them better.
And then it would become Monday.
And then like your whole life comes storming back at you. But like, there was something about that community and that world that I was like, are we not all laughing at this? I was in a seminar and they started out by saying something like, I'm in a room full of powerful people. And I lost my mind. I was like laughing. I was like, okay. They're like, it takes a powerful person to take a course to change their life. And I just started writing stuff down on my phone because it's like, in an even more powerful person to lead one. And that's where Dale Thorhammer was really born.
I love the name, by the way.
Thank you. I wanted something that's like, what's the most like alpha male name I could think of, but is still inherently kind of dumb. And I was like, if someone like, you know, Dale Thorhammer, and people call him Thornhammer. Like, I'm like, how do you not get it? It's like Thor's hammer. You just put it together.
Exactly, yeah. So inspiration, obviously, from folks like Tony Robbins.
I love Tony Robbins. Like, unironically, I love Tony Robbins. Uh-huh. I've been to so many of his seminars, and they've greatly impacted me. I would say that out of all of the personal development work that I've done, Tony Robbins is my favorite. It is the most fun. It's the most relaxed. Like, I remember when I went to one of those seminars, you go in, like, skeptical. And then he starts dropping F-bombs, and it just, like, I'm, like, writing stuff down on my phone. I'm like, this is, like, really good information that's coming out. And he's a wonderful showman.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And he puts so much spectacle into those seminars. And they're also, like, the longest ones. Like, I think David Destiny is, like, 6 days or something like that. So there's definitely some influence. I think some of the more loving parts of Dale Thorhammer are Tony Robbins. But the things that I'm going after in terms of, like, what I'm satirizing are those – like
more Stuart Smalley type.
Yeah,
you're good, like, enough and smart enough.
And I believe, yeah, like, well, Dale is definitely like that puffed out chest bravado. So it's right. Like that person that is, they're not really addressing themselves, but they're telling you how to live your life. I'm sure we've all met people like that where one of the things I like to say is, like, don't get a life coach when you can be a life coach. Like, go tell other people how to live their lives. Even if you are not living your life in that way, you know better than them. So
that's the way I feel about voiceover work. You're teaching voiceover? Are you really doing voiceover?
Are you working? No. Those who can't do, teach, right? Like, we've all heard that saying. So, like, that was the world that, especially down in L.A., like, I'm you know, immersed in a community down there, and you see people that are posting these inspirational quotes on Instagram, and they're just like, oh, it's so good to be in flow and truly living in my highest excitement. And you're like, dude, like, you were crying and drunk 2 days ago. What? Like,
and you're a barista.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I just love, you know, mixing the different types of frappuccinos together. It's really my highest excitement. No, everyone, but honestly, everyone is an entrepreneur. Everyone is a brand. Everyone is trying to upsell some kind of seminar that they are teaching. Everyone has a TEDx talk, and I'm just like, what world is this where we can't just be ourselves, but we all have to be leaders in industry? Mm-hmm. And that was like, it's that kind of like perspective that I'm like, well, Dale Thorhammer is all of those things, and not only is all of those things, but he's the pinnacle of all of those things. So like, the show opens with this, like, you know, almost like propaganda film for who Dale Thorhammer is and how amazing he is. And everything that I put into this show is about, it has to be inherently stupid to me. Like, you have to watch and be like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, yet there's some kind of nugget of truth to it. I want people leaving feeling amazing about themselves. And I've built things into the show so that they do. No matter what, you're going to leave feeling amazing. Because I'm tricking you into doing it. Like, if you scream, I love myself, I love myself, I love myself 6 times, your subconscious is going to be like, okay, I guess I kind of love myself, and you're going to feel good. So, like, it's a very interactive show, should you choose to, or should Dale make you choose to, which he will.
Well, you mentioned that Tony Robbins was more not so much parody, but inspiration for you.
Yes.
Is anything lifted verbatim from some of these other lesser known or other seminars that you've attended?
I'm trying not to do verbatim because I never want to be sued. And I don't know, like, parody law or satire around that. But there is some stuff from, like, I did Landmark Education, which is, I know they have a big presence here in the Bay Area. And there's some things that are in Landmark that are so confusing to the human ear when you hear it the first time. So I play on those kind of vibes where it's like, this sentence doesn't make sense when you hear it the first time. But I'm going to keep saying it as if you understand it. So there's a phrase like, you know, enroll others and you're already having gotten, which is a Landmark thing, which it's English words. And you're like, well, I should understand what that means, but I yet have no idea. But then once you go through their weekend seminar, it, you know, they teach you in a sense what those words mean and how that sentence strings together. I, as Dale, will never teach you what my nonsense means, but I will say it as if you already understand it. So those are the elements in which I'm satirizing the distribution method rather than the content itself.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you must have a favorite inspirational line or phrase that either made you crazy or just made you fall over laughing.
I mean, being you're already having gotten is one that I'm just like, what? That, you know, I have one that's not appropriate for public radio that's in the show that I really love. But actually, some of the things just kind of come to me. There's a lot of original stuff in there. Like, I just actually put in this new segment that is brand new to the San Francisco show, and it is don't fake it till you make it, feel it till you reel it.
Oh my.
And so I'm going through the whole idea of manifestation, like, you know, being of the energy of that of already having had, you know.
So. My favorite, I was back in the day, I used to do weddings on Long Island when I was in New York, and I was a flute player in a little trio that we used to do, and like wedding factories out on Long Island, and these rabbis would come in and offer this advice to the bride and groom. My favorite was, remember, the only thing different between unite and untie is where you put the eye. That one just stuck with
me. Yeah. I mean, there are all these like little things. Like, I think Landmark says something about like divorce. Not, they don't say divorce your story outright, but I have a big segment of my show where I talk about divorcing one's story around themselves. And then I wax poetic about the story that Dale himself had to divorce. And one of the things that I find to be a common thread in all of these motivational gurus is that they all have these incredible sob stories. And it's like, look at what I've had to overcome. You know, don't be who you think you are. Be who I think you are.
You had it lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I, you know, like you guys think you have problems. I had to walk to school in the rain. So, like, Dale's sob story, again, I wanted to keep it stupid, lighthearted, is just the most generic, like, I had to walk to school from the car every day. My family, we didn't have enough. We didn't have enough. And we couldn't afford to eat between meals. It was treacherous. So, like, he's telling this, like, sob story with, like, his whole heart about, like, look what I've overcome. But it's just, like, I'm pretty much taking my Marin County upbringing and telling it as if it was the most painful thing that anyone's ever had to go through.
Well, some of your inspiration must have been from your being an intern for the Colbert Report and back on the day when Conan was the rightful heir to the Tonight Show. Tell us a little bit about those experiences.
Well, Colbert was, like, the summer of 2008 was the best summer of my life thus far. Next to this one. This one's great, too. I'm good in a base 8 system. But, yeah, we've got I'm out in New York City working for Colbert, and this is, like, this summer where we were producing his Christmas special, if you ever saw it. And you got to choose a member of the staff to shadow for a day, except for Stephen. And I chose to shadow one of the writers. And, you know, like, the kind of rule was, like, you're not a writer, just, like, witness, just watch. And we're in the writer's room, and they're pitching. You know, they're doing their morning pitch. And I kind of mumble a joke under my breath. And they go, what did you just say? And it was something about, like, a man had been discovered to be alive after 80 years missing. And I said something like, oh, it was John McCain. And, like, it got a laugh from the room. And I don't know what happened, but from then, they seemed like they were okay with me pitching. And I actually wound up getting a joke on the show.
Wow.
Yeah. Awesome. And that changed my whole life right then and there. I was just like, this is what I want to be doing. And, you know, Stephen took the time to meet with all the interns, and that he would impart, like, you know, his wisdom. And we actually just had our 10-year reunion and went to go see The Late Show.
Oh, nice.
And got to follow up with him. Uh-huh. But he said, never make the victim of the situation the subject of the joke, like the butt of the joke,
right,
because people will laugh, but it sounds like they have blood in their mouths.
Yeah, it's like when you slip on a banana peel, it's not funny if the person actually gets
exactly
hurt.
Exactly, yeah. And I, you know, I took that to heart because I'm like, here's a dude that's, like, gone through all of this. He's learned the hard lessons. I might as well take it to heart. And he also said, get in shape before you're 30, because after that, it's much harder. So, yeah.
Yes, I'll attest.
So I took that style, that tone, because I loved how he took satire and he brought, like, the opposite opinion to the highest level of ridiculousness, and then people were able to be like, oh, okay, well, like, now we see where this is going. And I went back to my college at the University of Arizona and started up my own localized version of, like, The Daily Show / Colbert Report. And I like to think that what I'm doing right now is personal development meets Colbert. But what I had to learn early on is I can't take the opposite point of view in the way that Stephen used to when he was in that character, because people would just listen to that opposite point of view. So I found that I have to have the correct point of view. Dale Thorhammer gives good advice with the worst logic. And that's what I found that I have to do, because otherwise the content gets very triggering when you hear these ridiculous things coming out of someone's mouth that's supposed to be satirical, but it's still, you know, they carry some weight. So everything I say is uplifting. I learned that early on when I was in Australia doing this show at the Adelaide Fringe Festival. I had people crying, and I was like, this isn't why I'm doing this. I was like, I want you leaving feeling good.
Rewrite.
Yeah, I was like, okay, like, clearly, like, we can't go into the darkness, but I can lift people into the light. So all of the questions that I ask on that stage are very pointed towards uplifting things. Where do you want to be? How do you want your life to go? So it's like, kind of, instead of saying, what don't you like about your life? Because that puts people into their negative space and they start focusing on it. I say, what do you like about your life? And it's just the power of good question asking that allows us to have a really fun, playful time while addressing some of this ridiculous elements of personal development.
Very nice. Yeah. Ross Everett is Dale Thorhammer in Stop Stopping the Unstoppable, written and performed by Ross Everett, now through the 28th of July at The Marsh, themarsh.org, for more information. Ross, I wish you a great run at The
Thank
Marsh.
Thank you so much. I hope to see you there one time.
Yeah, you're listening to Open Air on KLW 91.7 FM. I'm Peter Robinson, sitting in this week for David LaTulip. And our next guests coming up today are from the Mime Troupe. Now, let me explain something I've just discovered about the word mime. In ancient Greek, it actually meant exaggeration, theatre of the exaggeration. So if you think you're going to see Jacques Tati or you're running around thinking there's going to be some French miming going on, this is not what you're going to see at all. In fact, it is live and very topical theatre. And I'm glad to welcome our two spokespeople. They know everything you need to know about what's going on with the Mime Troupe. So the opening show is called Seeing Red, a time-traveling musical. And let me let them introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. My name is Ellen Callis.
And we also have a sound person with us who puts all the music together behind the various productions.
My name's Taylor Gonzalez, collective member and sound designer, yeah.
Okay, Ellen and Taylor, yeah, welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about this show, because it runs throughout the summer. It runs, in fact, until September. It's in some of the major parks here in San Francisco, and then you're taking trips down to Santa Cruz, and I think you go even further north in California and beyond. So what's a little bit about the history of this company? How did it come together?
The San Francisco Mime Troupe first started off as the R.G. Davis Mime Troupe, started by a man named Ron Davis. It was kind of an avant-garde theater company based in a lot of dance, pantomime form back in 1959. 1960, a changed format based still in a lot of the masked commedia dell'arte. And as the 60s grew, it became more and more political and took a lot of the classic commedia plays, for example, and put the modern political twist, for example, infusing plays with the issues of the Vietnam War. One of the most controversial first popular mime troupe shows was called The Minstrel Show, and Civil Rights in a Cracker Barrel. And it toured around, and everybody in the play was in blackface, white and black people, and there was an interlocutor, and it was done in the style of an old minstrel show, and it brought forth issues that are still relevant today: police brutality, racial profiling, and it was highly controversial and highly successful in getting its point across.
Good. So it definitely tuned in to the issues of the day, issues of the time. And I think looking at the title, Seeing Red, a time-traveling musical, in fact, it actually begins in 1918 or thereabouts. Is that correct?
And actually, that's incorrect. It actually starts in 2018.
2018,
right.
Okay.
In Union, Ohio, in a bar in Union, Ohio. And our heroine, is a person named Bob. And she is completely disillusioned on her way to getting drunk on the eve of the 2018 election.
Okay. We're going to get our 20s and 19s right here.
So it's all about the 18s and the 8s.
Okay, we got it. Now, tell me from a sound person's point of view, Taylor, what is the range of music? What are we likely to hear?
We have a lot of different styles. We go a little bit of vaudevillian when we travel back in time. And when we're in modern times, Bob has a very hardcore rock sound to it. And so we got a lot of different ranges in between all of the different time periods that we go for all the characters. We try not to stretch too far into the future and getting into the 1940s, because we don't want to confuse people too much. So we tried as much as we could to stay true to the actual time periods.
Good. So we're going to hear a piece now, and I think maybe you can talk us through it and explain who's singing this and how it relates to the show.
When they see us join the fight, they'll treat us better when we get back.
You're over there breathing mustard gas while some fat cat that hot dog sits on his ass and rules at the schools of fools like you. So proud to be killing and dying in the stench of a trench in Belgium or France, while he pockets his buckets of cash in advance for the guns and the shells and the ranks of tanks. The world so eagerly
finds. Yep. So what's happening here?
So this is a meeting between two characters, Ruby and Henry, after Henry has come back from World War I. This is them meeting for the first time in Ruby's bar, and they are not too happy about seeing each other in this moment.
So we are talking about 2018.
We're talking now about
1918. 1918, right.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so back to World War I,
yes.
The period immediately afterwards, and they're meeting in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of message of this song is what?
The message of this song is them fighting over their differences of opinion in that time period and realizing that it's going to take a bit more than fighting a war that they might not fully believe in, and how their political views need to shape where they're going to be taking themselves throughout the future, racially as well as politically.
So we've got race, we've got war, and we've got some kind of glimpse as to what could be happening by the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the story move to?
Well, at this point in 1918, Eugene Debs, their candidate, is receiving votes in the presidential election, but he's in jail. He's been jailed at this point for sedition. So whereas they were enthusiastic 4 years earlier, they're feeling a bit discouraged. And Henry, who's come back from the war as a black man who served, finds the country that he's come back to is still the same old racist, exclusionary country. So the idea of fighting for a democracy and freedom that he doesn't partake in or can't partake in, and for Ruby, she doesn't have the vote, and she's a Chinese American who later will be victimized by the Exclusion Act. So
so we've got two dispossessed people who've gone through a whole pitch of fighting for different reasons and a belief in democracy, but are denied even any form of representation.
And a belief in a socialist ideal, social mm-hmm. democratic yeah. ideal.
And then where does the story move on to? Are we in the 1940s? Do we go through the 1930s?
No, actually, We start in 2018. Bob travels back to 1912.
Okay.
And then back to 2018. Okay. And then back to 1918.
Okay.
And then back to 2018.
Well, I hope there's a timekeeper on all of this.
We have a big clock that spins on stage, so...
so you know where you are and where you're at. Yeah.
We do our best.
Okay. And just in terms of carrying what I call a contemporary message, how does it relate to what's happening in the world today?
Well, I feel that one of the most important messages right now is to know your history. And I think that that for me, as a Californian, 1978, when the schools were the Jarvis-Gann bill passed, and schools, as you know, as part of the school district, were suddenly defunded, and a lot of stuff has been cut. And over the years, the dismantling of the education that our students get, the absence of civics, for example,
mm-hmm.
and ethics, and the revisionist history that seems to be coming forward is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that at a time right now when people are very disillusioned, many of us, with what's going on the national front, it's important to know that even though it may be hard now, there's always been a struggle, and each victory that we've achieved, we have achieved it by standing on the shoulders of those that have gone before, you know. And so you got to keep pushing that rock up the hill and hope that and know that, you know,
hope it doesn't roll down again.
Well, it, yeah.
Well, and know that you're not alone, that you're there with everybody else in that same struggle.
Well, let's hear another piece of music, and again, if we can relate this to what's going on.
Hey, Rockefeller, put away the caviar. We're here to show you where to stick the big cigar.
and take a sledgehammer to the color bar.
Time for you to know those days are dead. Seeing red, seeing red. The waters are rising on the riverbed. Seeing red. The word has spread. A new way of being.
So we work both Rockefeller and Hitler into this. We work big cigars. We've got that huge class distinction between the haves and the have-nots. Is that part of the message in different ways?
Different ways, yeah. Everybody in this story at the moment is they're fighting their own struggle, but they're all able to come together and in the group of the Wobblies and put their struggles in a positive direction and a direction that they can hopefully create a better future for themselves and for everybody in their community of workers and people who can't work.
And how many people do we have in the cast? How big or small is this production?
It's a four-person cast, but we have probably about 8 or 9 characters throughout the show that
and
they
all
portray.
And you have a band that plays with you?
A three-person band,
three-person
yes.
band. Now, you're performing in different venues, so do you need scenery or do you need backdrops of any sort, or is it straightforward four people on stage?
We bring it with us. Everywhere we go, we have a big truck. We're very itinerant in the classic style. We pull our truck up into the park early in the morning. We unload the stage. We set it up. We perform.
Right.
We take it down. We put it back in the truck.
Oh, my goodness. So it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work for about an hour and a half worth of actual performance. But we all do it. You know, we believe if you're going to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. So everybody does everything. No prima donnas allowed.
Okay. And, no spotlight on me.
It doesn't really work. Yeah. Not for us.
And how long have you both been involved with the company?
I've been involved with the company since 1986.
Mm-hmm.
32 years.
I've been with the company for about 12 years now, but I started as a student with our program because we also have a high school teaching program that we do. And then the last 3 or 4 years now, my time has been spent as the sound designer and sound engineer for the company.
So the title, I think, in many ways says it all, Seeing Red. We're definitely looking at it from a socialist point of view. Is that reasonable to describe it? And then from a time-traveling point of view, we're looking at different moments in history where change has been about to happen but not necessarily happened the way you expected it to.
Right. Well, it's also Seeing Red in the other sense of if you're agitated and you're angry, what are you going to do about it? If you don't like something, change it. You know, the class struggle continues. It's nothing new. So
that's it. Okay.
That's it. We continue on, rallying the forces.
Well, again, look out at different parks around San Francisco or down in Santa Cruz. And I want to thank you both, Ellen Callis and
You can
Taylor.
Go to our website, too, to find the full schedule.
Good. Yeah. Can
it's www.sfmtsanfranciscomimetroupe.org. sfmt.org.
And thank you, Taylor, for talking to us about the music.
You're
and
welcome.
We wish you well. Carry your message loud and carry it often.
Thank you very much.
To Open Air this week. I'm Peter Robinson, standing in for David Latulli. Our mastermind engineer today, Damien, we want to thank you for your kind assistance as the program was produced by Neil Sprinkles. And next week, same hour, same time, same flower, KLW 91.7, Open Air.